WISE Awards are back for 2024 and early bird entries are still open. These awards recognise the best use of digital media, marketing and commerce, and they also celebrate innovation and expertise right across the digital marketing industry. There are more categories than ever before to enter, so visit exchangewire.com/events to find out more.
The MarTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the ExchangeWire MarTech Podcast, bringing you all the latest from the worlds of media, marketing and commerce. Today, I am delighted to be joined by an all ExchangeWire lineup. And first off, CEO Rachel Smith. Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, John. Pleasure to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you. And joining us is ExchangeWire COO, Lindsay Rountree. Lindsay, welcome.
Hello.
We are in a bit of a haze post-ATS. We had a very celebratory ATS London yesterday. It was a wonderful event. We're going to dive into it throughout the stories today. But yeah, first off, Rachel, how are you feeling after ATS London yesterday?
Teeny bit tired, but, you know, good tired. A little bit croaky, lots of talking. But otherwise, very, I would say, optimistic and uplifted. It was fantastic. I mean, you know, in the sort of preparation for the opening slides that I presented yesterday, I'd worked out that we've been doing it for 14 years. And actually, the benefit to that is that you've got 14 years worth of relationships with people in the industry. So that's one of the reasons that explains why these days, whenever I go to ATS, and I think when a lot of other people go to ATS too, it just feels like a great big reunion because we've all been working together for the last 14 years. So after an evening of that, catching up with people, having lots of conversations, reflecting on what happened on stage yesterday, I feel very uplifted about the industry, the ups and the downs, the goods and the bads. I feel now like we've really kind of coming together as a mature group of professionals that can actually put our minds to solving some of the, you know, some of the more gritty issues that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, left me feeling very positive, but just requiring a bit more sleep. Thanks very much.
Yeah, certainly a fair point. Lindsay, how do you feel after ATS London? Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. I'm exhausted, but I feel very buoyant. I think that, not to blow our own trumpet, but I think it was one of our better ATS Londons. It was a really, really positive day. Lots of really good on-stage discussions, lots of really good off-stage discussions as well. Really good crowd there. Great to see both familiar and less familiar faces in the room. And yeah, I thought it was a brilliant day. I had a great time.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. Good tired, but what a fantastic event. And sod it, let's blow our own trumpet. It was really great.
And I mean, like we had, two proper goats, ad tech legends, speaking on the stage, who've both spoken on the stage at ATS London before, but, not for a while. Jeff Green, not for many years, so it was great to have him back again. And Andrew Casale, at least a good couple of years since we've seen him at ATS London too. So it was fantastic. You know, we haven't had those sorts of fireside chat conversations with those guys for a long time. And so much has changed in the world of ad tech in the intervening years between the last time they would have popped into ATS London to yesterday. So really good to get an update from both of them about what's happening in their businesses and also their perspectives on the industry.
Yeah, it was fantastic to have them both. And both of their fireside chats actually touched on the current situation with Google, which is where we're going to start today. Oh, Google. So for the first bit of news is UK's Competition and Markets Authority have released its provisional findings that Google has abused its dominant positions through the operation of both its publisher ad server and buying tools to restrict competition within the region. This sounds familiar. This is a ruling from the UK, but obviously the huge DOJ case is going on currently on the other side of the pond with big ramifications. We talked about the breakup of Google at ATS yesterday. Lindsay, you chaired that panel. How are you feeling about Google's ad stack, where it is currently, and this mounting legal challenges against them and the position they occupy in the market? Lindsay, I'll throw that to you.
Well, I feel like generally everybody is of the consensus that the ad business needs to be separated from Google. And I think that, you know, there's many reasons for that. But I think that what was really highlighted in the panel yesterday, we had James Rosewell from Movement for an Open Web. We had Adora Mikkel Klendinen from Ozone Project. And we had Danish Murthy from Credbank, which is a Swedish startup, kind of B2B bank. And the consensus was, okay, if that happens, first of all, it's going to take a long time. Like, we can't be expecting things to happen overnight or things to happen tomorrow. But secondly, it will leave a gap that needs to be filled. And I don't think anyone's necessarily ready to fill that gap yet, apart from the big walled gardens. And I thought what was interesting was we ran a poll for the audience in the room, and it was a very full room, asking them kind of what they thought would be the main outcome of a breakup of Google's ad business. And the options were nothing will change. There'll be a flurry of new ad tech startups coming up. Independent ad tech will win. The only winners here will be the walled gardens, the existing walled gardens like Meta, Apple, etc. Or the new spun out Google Shop will still retain most of the ad spend. And the majority of the audience believed that this new spun out Google Shop, whatever that looks like, which, you know, arguably would be fully interoperable with Google and Google's existing or remaining tech stack, whatever is left of that, that's where the ad spend will go. What I thought was also interesting was James Rosewell, who is obviously so, if you don't know what he's about, like, look him up, but he's obviously so clued up in exactly what's happening with each of the various trials happening against Google, and in particular the CMA one, because he was involved in CMA, getting involved in Google in the first place. But he said that it's not in the regulators' interests to make things more difficult for Google's customers. Like, they don't want that. They don't want to make the customers, you know, like Credbank, for example, have to go, well, I've got no idea what to do now. I can't use Google. Or if I do use Google, I don't want to use Google. What do I do next? It's in their interests to allow for really easy data access and data interoperability between the new spun out business and other existing businesses outside of the walled gardens that exist. So if that's the case, that would make it simple. But what I also found interesting was that, you know, Ciaran alluded to on stage when he was speaking with Andrew Casale from Windows Exchange, that there were some rumours going around, as he'd heard from a few people, that Google was planning on making an announcement today, I believe, that they were going to announce a breakup kind of ahead of the DOJ ruling. Now, if they do that and there's no regulatory ruling, what does that then mean look like for all the things that regulators don't want to happen? If Google just go, fine, whatever, we're going to do it off our own backs and ourselves, I don't understand what that means in terms of how regulators get involved. And if that then means that this whole data access thing that James was referring to, and they want to make it easy for Google's customers, if that then still applies, and if it doesn't, then we're kind of very much back to square one in terms of what that looks like and how we fill that void. And the consensus seemed to be a lot of the budget will go to the other walled gardens. It'll go to this new Google Shop. And while there is opportunity for independent ad tech to thrive here, it's down the line. It's not immediate and would take some doing. So some really interesting perspectives that I thought was absolutely fascinating.
Lindsay, remind me of the poll results. Like you said, if you can remember, like you said, there was a big proportion of people that felt that the spend was just going to go to whatever replacement of, you know, a broken up version of Google would look like. Was there still quite a high proportion that, like you said, felt like independent ad tech would get an opportunity out of this? Was it split, or was there a vast majority to, the old Google alternative?
It was split. There are about 15% of people that believed, of the audience, that believed that there'd be a flurry of new ad tech companies that would pop up to kind of help take on this new surge of demand. So a cottage industry, if you like. And another 15% felt that independent ad tech would win out of this. So if you combine those two, you're looking at about a third that believe that the non-walled gardens and the non-new Google Shop will win out of this. But the majority, I think it was 38 to 40%, believed that this new Google Shop would, the spun out ex-Google business would take the majority. So it was fairly even. It did highlight, I think we were all fairly surprised at how even the results were on the panel. And it was nice to see that not everybody was being, like, had a negative outlook on it, basically, I thought, anyway.
Yeah, I really enjoyed, I think Danush came up with the analogy. It's like, so if I'm running a car and then tomorrow they tell me there's no petrol left, how does my car move? That was his, you know, that was his analogy for what happens if Google's broken up, which I thought hit the nail on the head, really, in terms of the concerns that businesses will have around Google being broken up. I think he, you know, he spoke to us for a Vox Pop before the event and said, I think I'm going to be taking a contradictory position to everyone else because I'm not sure about the breakup of Google at all. And I think that was probably borne out in the room. He was very much on his own on stage, but for very good reasons, and certainly held his own in the discussion. But yeah, Rachel, how do you feel about the potential breakup and what these legal rulings mean for Google going forward?
I mean, I think it's starting to really heat up and get super interesting right now because of the DOJ case over in the US and this recent CMA ruling. So I do think the consequences of a scenario where Google just decide to divest voluntarily of the ad tech stack, exactly how Lindsay has described, could be concerning for the industry because we then won't be sure how much jurisdiction regulators would have over what that divestiture looks like because they're not being forced to do it. And also it could be the type of solution that just further extends this no man's land of we don't really quite know what this will ultimately look like, what that means for the likes of Danush and other marketers who are still an SME sized business and rely heavily on the Google ad stack is they'll be able to just proceed with business as usual for a while whilst all this other nonsense goes on in the background. And I just imagine, you know, Google taking things into their own hands will extend things further because the regulators won't just go, oh, okay, you guys are going to take control of it. All right, we'll go and do something else then.
Yeah, they'll cool. Still be, crack on, guys.
Exactly. They'll still just be keenly looking at what's going to happen next. So I can just imagine, you know, cue a whole raft more of complications. So I wouldn't want to see that happen. On the other hand, I mean, you know, the legal department at Google must be going, oh God, seriously, guys, do we have to keep defending every single element of our business? Can we not work out a better way to make this business operate? So, you know, you've got to imagine that at some point they're going to start losing their appetite for continually going back to court to fight what feels like an indefensible corner. And I'm reminded somewhat of the hoo-ha that went on back in, well before COVID. It's got to be maybe 2017, maybe 2018, down in Australia, where the Competition Commission in Australia got involved in Google and Facebook actually trying to negotiate deals with Australian publishers to ensure that advertising revenue was actually being returned to those publishers. So two things had happened at the same time. The first is that the Competition Commission in Australia had decided that Google and Facebook were not returning enough revenue to publishers and that was an anti-competitive practice. And so they introduced a media bargaining code that effectively meant if you wanted to use publishers' content, you had to agree to returning a certain volume of the advertising revenue back to those publishers. Google's very initial first reaction when that piece of legislation came down the line was to absolutely take a defensive stance, and they came up with all sorts of quite frankly ridiculous arguments about why they deserved all of the advertising revenue and how much they were actually helping publishers by sending traffic to their site. It was an unbelievably an immature and unprofessional argument that they rolled out at the time. Fortunately for them, this was down in Australia where, you know, with a population of 20 million people and where the rest of the world doesn't really pay much attention to what goes on there. So they kind of got away with it. But if they'd use an argument like that in a US court, oh my Lord, they'd just be thrown out. And of course they were, you know, they were not taken seriously by the Australian legal system either. And those arguments were dismissed almost immediately. But it just reminds me that this is very often their first line of defense, which is, we're not doing anything wrong. And, you know, as was mentioned a couple of times yesterday, I'm pretty sure James mentioned it and maybe even Andrew Casale mentioned it. One of their points of defense for this DOJ claim is, well, the industry is really complicated. So, yeah, you know, in a complicated industry, what do you expect us to do, guys? And not only is it complicated, that also means that there's plenty of competition and plenty of opportunity for everyone. And the whole thing just feels so ill thought through. I'm not saying the whole DOJ case. I'm quite sure they've got significant arguments that they're constructing and trying to put together. Anyway, long winded way of saying I feel like the heat is not going to diminish, and Google have got to find a way out of this. what that looks like for the industry. I am similar to everyone that answered the poll question during your panel yesterday, Lindsay. I'm torn. I'm really not sure whether it's going to actually benefit the industry. But I do think that continued conversation about Google's dominance, everything that's associated with it, the impact it's had on the advertising industry and on the publishing industry is good for ad tech, because it's reminding everyone, as I said in my opening slides yesterday, there's never been a more important moment to be protecting independent ad tech, not just to the extent that it exists, but to the extent that we need to create a marketplace where it has the ability to thrive. So all of this, I think, is good for ad tech. All of this conversation is good for ad tech.
Yeah, one thing I found fascinating from having Andrew Casale and Jeff Green in their separate discussions with Ciaran yesterday, and this is an oversimplification, I think, but one thing that came through when we were talking about how both Index Exchange and the Trade Desk have reached their current position is that they took their line, they found their kind of piece of the pie and just got very good at it, whereas Google became, as Jeff Green said, wanted to be the attacker, the defender and the referee. They didn't stop at anything. They got muddied and grew and grew and grew on being everything. And that's, you know, that's how a monopoly is born. And it was great to hear them both kind of put in plain language that they stuck to their lane basically and just grew. And, you know, we know how big the Trade Desk and Index both are now. But yeah, it was fascinating. And this is obviously the court case is the culmination of that, being not one side, but both sides, and not, you know, and owning it all. So it's really interesting. And obviously we'll be keeping a very close eye on the DOJ case and this new CMA case as well. Because it's, yeah, big ramifications for independent ad tech.
Absolutely. I found some of what both Jeff and Andrew spoke about with respect to the way that they constructed their businesses really interesting, because in both cases they weren't necessarily first to the market with the, you know, with the tech solutions that they were bringing to the industry, and they both had a slightly different way of sort of couching that. You know, for Jeff, I think what we were honing in on was the fact that many people, including Ciaran, told him that he was launching a DSP in an already crowded market, and so it wouldn't go anywhere. Ha ha ha. But that, you know, but that from his perspective, like you said, John, he was just focusing on doing a better job, you know, doing a good job, and then doing a better job than his competitors, and dedicating himself to it. Right, this whole hard work pays off. Actually, what you see over the course of time is that it's all about consistent quality, incremental change, and you get that by committing yourself making sure that you're giving your best efforts at every step along the way. And then Andrew's interpretation of that from an Index perspective is that, you know, he sort of said Index are very often not first movers in the market, but we're the guys that turn up late to the party with a fresh keg of beer. You know, if you're going to arrive late, then you better arrive with a good product and with something that differentiates you from your competitors and stick at it. And, you know, like you said, John, both of those stories characterize a completely different mindset to the one that Google's executives must have, because they run that business in a completely different way.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I will move us on to our second story of the day. And for the first time, online has overtaken television for UK news. Research by the broadcast regulator Ofcom has revealed that 71% of the population said they use online services for news versus 70% who watch TV news bulletins. This is big for online news. This is, you know, the traditional bastion of news has been TV, and now we're seeing people head online to digital services. Lindsay, what does this mean for UK publishers?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I was actually surprised that it was for the first time ever online news overtaken TV news. I was like, what?
I thought who's it happened years TV ago. News? 100%.
Apart from like my dad, I don't know who watches the 6 o'clock news. Like, I really don't. So yeah. I just thought that everybody was getting their news online. I really did. I have about 30,000 notifications a day on my phone from different news sources telling me what's going on in the world. I would never go onto a news channel or look at a news bulletin on the TV. Generational thing, maybe, I don't know. And maybe, the, you know, what I always need to remember about this kind of stuff is that what I might do sitting here in London is very, very different from what the rest of the country does. And the rest of the country is like, when you chat to Ciaran, he goes, who watches Saturday Night Takeaway? It's like, literally everyone in the country watches it. You might not watch it, but everyone in the country is obsessed with that show. So what we may not understand about the kind of the nature of TV consumption in the UK more broadly, and certainly generationally, you know, is you know, I could keep going on about it. It's fascinating to me. But I think that this is a really good opportunity for publishers, and it ties in so well with a lot of the conversations we've had on recent podcasts. And I'm assuming on stage yesterday as well. Unfortunately, I had to miss the publisher conversations because I was on stage in a different room. But certainly around the notion of marketers and publishers working together to solve the issue of advertising on and correctly reimbursing publishers for news content and news journalism, certainly around the situation with suppression lists, block lists, whatever you call them, and ensuring that the right keywords are being used and that content isn't being unfairly missed, and using different types of targeting signals to ensure that you're getting yourselves in front of that news content, because it's a huge opportunity for news journalists. It's a huge opportunity, and I think it's one that's probably being missed, not just across kind of the long tail publishers, but across the big premium publishers too. And it really shows it's time for us to make sure that we solve that massive issue, because this represents the future of how we are consuming our news. And, you know, also I've seen, maybe not so much in this country, but in the US, there's a lot of news anchors who are popular and known by name, same in this country too, but they've now got their own TikTok profiles and they're actually kind of getting a name for themselves on TikTok. So that's how the younger generation is consuming news online. Another huge opportunity to be able to get publishers out there in different ways, and work out how they can diversify revenue streams. There's loads of stuff here.
Yeah, definitely. Rachel.
100%. And Lindsay, I had the benefit of being in the room during the publisher discussions, because I was moderating a session in that room. And exactly that topic came up. John, you were moderating that fantastic discussion between Caroline Fenner at Pink News and the other person on the panel.
Rob Bradley
from CNN.
Rob Bradley, yeah. Sorry, Rob. Sorry, Rob.
Oh, and then she calls him Brad. This is hilarious.
I gave Rob a really big hug as well. He's going to be like, how did you screw up that? You forgot I was on the panel. You didn't get my name right. Jesus.
Thank you very much, Brad Robley, for joining the panel.
Brad Robley was great on it, and so was Caroline Fenner. But she raised a really good point, which is that, you know, if you go back to the days, actually she was looking, you know, she was talking about traditional print media. If you go back to the days of traditional print media, the front page is where everybody wanted to be. It's where all the advertisers wanted to be. That was where the news headlines were as well. And she said there was never this correlation between appearing against the news headlines, because you wanted to be front and center. And then she also talked about News at 10 and television advertising, although what was it? Yeah, News at 10 ITV? I don't know. Anyway,
yeah,
whatever would have been.
To Trevor, that was definitely ITV.
There you go. So whichever broadcaster it was that would have been carrying advertising, the whole point is you wanted to be advertised around that time, just before it or just after it, because you knew that that's when people were going to be tuning in. So she really, I thought, brought home the point very nicely about the correlation between news, the amount of people that might be consuming it, and the opportunity for advertisers. Of course, representing Pink News, who are a publication that carries a lot of content for the LGBTQ plus community, she was saying so much of their content at the moment appears, you know, so many keywords associated with their content appears in block lists, and that's just not a sustainable position, certainly for them as a publisher, but it's also a massive missed opportunity for brands. So I thought that was a point really well made. And then Rob, or Brad, depending on what you want to call him, gave a really, a really articulate rundown of all of the wide range of activity that CNN and the entire CNN brand undertaking to diversify their monetization model. And so much of that could be associated with news anchors and, like you said, Lindsay, news personalities, famous news readers, because he talked about not just, you know, sort of newsletters and sign-up lists and special, you know, special sort of content that can be funneled to people that express particular interest in certain topics, but events. And you're seeing those news broadcasters design events around not just topics, but the people that they know, the audience want to see, present that content and information to them. So there is a huge opportunity now that we know for sure, like Lindsay, I thought it happened years ago too, but now that we know for sure, people are not really watching the news at 10 anymore. They're consuming it all in other environments. We've really got to get on top of that. Advertisers have to get on top of that. And, you know, publishers, no doubt, are all over it and are desperate to try to divert everybody's attention towards the opportunity. We need to make sure we've got the right ad tech tools in place to make that work because, yeah, it's totally underserved area of opportunity, I reckon.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a stat we've come to a couple of times on the podcast recently is that it's 1.2% of brand ad spend is going towards actual news coverage, digital news. And stats like this that now bear out that people are getting the majority of their news online, it just shows that there needs to be a reconsideration. I think both Rob and Caroline on my panel were making the point that this, like, the block lists need to be reconsidered. There needs to be another way of doing this. I made the point that, you know, it was revealed recently that some block lists still contain Ariana Grande and Manchester in the block lists. Paris is still on block lists following the Bataclan, whereas we've had the Olympics there. That is, you know, it took away a lot of money from the broadcasters and from online news because of block lists. And something the industry really does need to consider. It was a fascinating discussion with Rob and Caroline, and they were both great guests. So I really enjoyed the chat.
I think there's just one other angle to this though as well. Oh, there are many angles, but there's one other angle that springs to mind, which is I do think that we are entering a phase where people are perhaps a little more suspicious of the content they're consuming online and its authenticity. So there's obviously a fake news element and a sourcing element to this conversation, which also then blends into brand safety and so forth. So no doubt brands are edgy about where the content is coming from and whether, but then that just becomes an argument to invest more in premium publishers. But I also think consumers are a little less trusting of various sites and are concerned a bit more about the origin of the content they're consuming. That's a good thing though, not a bad thing. And we need to be doing more as an industry to sort of uphold all of the quality principles around that. And I think there's a huge opportunity for us to do that. On the AI panel that was in that same room earlier on in the day, it was really interesting. Katie Atkinson from The Runway, Runway Media, Runway Project. I mean, this is great. I'm just murdering all the ATS London guests and their job titles.
Runway Media.
Runway Media, that's it, yes.
And this is going very well.
Yeah, it's going very smoothly, as expected. She made the point that, there are a number of people who do, she's one of them, well, not enough people because she asked the audience, but she's one of them and a few people left their hands up. Actually pay to access LLMs and AI, large language models for content. And the whole point is that those LLMs then return some of that subscription money onto publishers, which is a completely different way of consuming content to the one that we're currently used to on the internet at large, which is we expect to consume all publisher-led content, even if it is quarterly journalism, for free. Yes, of course, there are paywalls and there are data walls and so forth, and that's becoming more common, but typically we think that's the standard business model. And she was saying it's interesting to watch LLMs flip that business model on the head. It's not to say that there won't be advertising probably appearing alongside some of those subscription services with time. But the whole point is they're starting from the basis of we can provide this content to you, but we charge you a fee and that fee gets returned back to the people that originally generated that content. So I think that is, an implication for news advertising as well.
Yeah, Caroline Fenner again had made the point on my panel. She was talking about, how revenue sources are changing and what publishers need to do. And one of the points she made was kind of they have to start making the most of their back catalogues. Basically, she used The Guardian as a case in point that, they've got 200 years of news and they're now signing deals to send that over. I think Sony's The Guardian's the partner in this, but to make stories, to make documentaries out of The Guardian's news coverage and the things that they've published over 200 years. So yeah, very interesting to see these revenue models changing, adapting, and AI, obviously the deals they have with AI companies to license the back catalogues is part of that. But yeah, interesting to see that moving away from paywalls, pay fences, and into new means of staying afloat in these times. So yeah, interesting times for the publishing industry.
It reminds me as well of Paul Gubbins shared on LinkedIn a link to a video that we put together after celebrating 10 years of ATS. And it just had some snippets from the previous 10 years from, can't remember the year, 2009, 2019, I think it was. And we had Dr. Boris Musikansky on stage, obviously the founder of Ipon Web as it was, talking back in 2017, maybe 2016, about the fact that, in fact, I think it was earlier than that, so it had been 10 years ago, talking about the fact that we need to be making sure we're properly monetizing, remunerating quality news journalism. And the same arguments were being made then as they're being made now. And yes, we're moving on, and yes, change is being made, but you know, it doesn't feel like it's quick enough. It really doesn't. If we're still having the same conversations 10 years on, that's worrying.
Yeah, it's not quick enough. And I do feel it is the sort of the Porsche, it's part of that value exchange that we talk about all the time when we talk about advertising. It's part of that value exchange that still hasn't been accelerated far enough or fast enough. And we need something to really push that along. I'm not sure what that thing is going to be, but you know, and it makes me wonder, maybe AI will get us there because of that conversation coming up. Well, if I'm using LLMs for search instead of search, well, where is that content coming from, and how do I know it's been verified, and who's, and how do those sources get funded, etc.? Maybe that will accelerate that thinking around where does the content that I'm consuming come from? I don't know.
Hopefully, as long as that's also remunerated correctly. Obviously, you mentioned that there are, the plan is if you pay for it, that money is going back into publishers. But we know of many publishers, especially independent publishers, that are taking certain AI models to court. You know, Mumsnet is a more recent one. There obviously is lots of cases in the US as well, because they're scraping their content without authorization. And that's another thing to consider. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Katie also gave, on the very same panel, she also gave a really interesting example of a AI picture generated startup that she set up, I think it was last year. And she said when it launched, it was great. The whole idea was an AI tool to provide, you know, pictures and picture references, I suppose, not quite Midjourney, but because that looks more like, you know, drawn content, cartoon style content. This is more a picture content. And it was using a number of AI tools to come up with the appropriate picture for the content that you were writing. And she thought, this is great. It's going to work really well in the advertising industry. She said, kicked it off. It went really well for the first couple of months. And then the quality of the pictures nosedived after the first 3 months, because all of the owners of that content started putting up paywalls or started putting up some kind of access wall. And suddenly the information that her AI startup was using to try to generate these quality pictures that just wasn't available anymore. The volume of information was no longer available. So
interesting.
Oh, Sebastian. Lindsay's just picked up her dog.
My dog is joining the podcast. He's very needy and wants attention.
He hasn't been on for such a long time. It's good to have him back.
Oh, a special guest. I'm sorry to our listeners that you cannot see Lindsay's dog, who's now joined us. This is great audio content. But no, rest assured, we now have a dog with us online.
Oh, dear. Day after ATS. Great.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Expect nothing less from us, honestly.
Absolutely not. So lots to keep an eye out in the publishing industry, and we'll be covering that all going forward. I'm going to wrap us up now for today. But before we go, I'm going to ask your ATS London highlights from 2024. Rachel, what was yours? What really made your day?
So many moments to choose from. I think one of the things I loved the most actually about ATS this year was the venue. I know that sounds really cheesy, but it was a really good, it was fantastic setup, easy to move around, brilliant stage setup, and everybody just looked great on it. All the photos that are coming through of all of the speakers and the ones that have been shared with speakers are like, oh, this is a really flattering photo of me on stage. Yes, it is. So that's really lovely. But also I just think it created that atmosphere. Quite a few people came up to me afterwards and said they felt like we were back in the BFI, which was our, the original home of ATS.
Original.
So that was lovely. In terms of the content, I just find it really hard to go past those morning sessions with Andrew Casale and Jeff Green, because it's been such a long time since we've had off the cuff conversations with those guys, and they are both really important figures in the ad tech industry because they're both the architects of very successful independent ad tech companies, and you know that provides the basis from which lots of other ad tech solutions have been built and developed. In terms of panel content, there was just so much to choose from. I think one of the things I really enjoy is all of the work that the ExchangeWide team puts into recruiting our publisher speakers, our agency speakers, and our brand speakers. When you see it come off at the end of the day, it gives you this really satisfying sense that all the hard work was worth it, right? There's a hell of a high volume of speakers that are required for all of those panel sessions. And every year I'm continually impressed by the quality of all of the people that are working in those component parts of the industry. And that's what, you know, that's what powers the world of advertising and marketing technology. So it was really great to see a whole bunch of new faces. But one of the faces that we always enjoy seeing who injects a bit of energy into ATS is Sean Odenay from Kinesso. And one of my favourite moments was that he sent all of his Kinesso colleagues up to the room where I was due to moderate the last panel. And that was to catch Nathan Taylor Billings, I think his surname is, on one of the publisher panels. I got it right, yeah, on one of the publisher panels. And poor Nathan, he was brilliant, by the way, but poor Nathan takes the stage and he's barely got the microphone to his mouth to introduce himself, and the whole room is like, yeah, cheering as though he'd, I don't know, scored a try for the England rugby team. And I know that Sean Odenay was single-handedly responsible for that. So that was one of my favourite moments.
So Sean did the same thing in my room. He made Kinesso colleagues come and watch Hannah Thompson speak about the transformation of precision targeting. And great. When she was announced, obviously all the Kinesso lot cheered for her. And then when Emily Hart from AKA and Chris Keenan from Group M both then introduced themselves, they were obviously getting nervous. They weren't going to get a cheer, and they both got a cheer as well. And then Nigel Clarkson from Tap Tap again got a cheer too. And I was like, where's my cheer? So everyone cheered, and I was like, ah, pity cheer. Thank you very much.
Nice.
I will take it.
But nice.
It was good. Yeah, it was, Sean brings that energy, as you said. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Lindsay, what were your particular highlights from yesterday?
I don't know. I'm still overwhelmed. Yeah, I am still overwhelmed. I'm taking time to distill it all. I think especially because, you know, we haven't had ATS London in September for a number of years since pre-COVID. I think it was really nice to have it back that time of year again. And I really felt like because we've had it in June for a couple of years, which has been among a lot of other industry events, I think this felt like everyone was having, you know, post-summer get-together. So the networking I felt was fantastic, and it really felt like everyone was so delighted to be in a room together and be able to kind of share this experience. And I felt very much part of that as well. I think that was really important. I agree with Rachel, having Jeff Green and Andrew Casale back on stage again in the fireside chats with Ciaran was brilliant. But I just feel like the combination of the audience being so receptive to all of the content across the entire day across the different streams of content as well, and also then being so receptive to getting together to catch up and network through networking breaks, it just made it all feel really, really, I don't use the word buoyant again, but I will do because I can't think of any other words. I'm too tired to think of new words. But it made the atmosphere of the entire day feel so buoyant, whether you were sitting in a panel or whether you were in the networking area. Yeah. And I loved that. I really, really did. It really felt like really, I really felt really proud to be part of it and have been partly responsible for delivering that to the industry.
100%. And I think the other thing, Lindsay, is that, plenty of people are always surprised to hear. We've a small team at ExchangeWire, so you weren't just part of it, Lindsay, as all of us at ExchangeWire know, you were a massive, massive part of it. And partly that's because we're a small team. So every single effort that everyone in the team contributes makes a huge difference. I also had a lot of people come up to me say that they felt that it was a really, the event was executed really smoothly. And, that is thanks to you guys, to everyone in the ExchangeWire team who have become experts at doing this now. And, I think people think that we've got a team of 30 people working behind the scenes. We don't.
We really don't.
We
As
really
Kieran
don't.
Pointed out, Jeff Green has a larger entourage than he has employees at Exchange Wire. And that wasn't hyperbole.
Nope.
It wasn't. What about you, John? What were your favourite moments?
I mean, I've been thanking Lindsay for weeks for giving me the panels I was given.
Would not shut up about it.
Honestly, I've been telling everyone.
Right in your sweet
spot. I've been telling everyone how excited I am, including my six-month-old child who can't talk back. I've been telling him how excited I am about my CTV panel. As always with ATS for me, it's the people. I really enjoy getting the viewpoints. I really enjoy the insights we get from our panelists. And this year I was absolutely delighted to be doing the CTV panel and one of the publisher panels. It was both I knew would be cracking discussions, and very grateful to all my panelists for that. And then just the chance to, like you've both said, there was a real buzz about it from the kickoff, from arriving. It's like this atmosphere, there's something special about today. People are here to see each other, to listen. They were very enthusiastic about what the team had put together. And so, it was just a pleasure. But the atmosphere for me and, like I said, my wonderful panels that I have not stopped talking about for the last few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, what a day. I also felt like it whizzed on by, and a few people said that to me too. And I think that is testament to the fact that it was packed day, lots of relevant content, lots of, everyone in the industry there. Time flies when you're having fun.
Exactly.
Cool. We will going to leave it there for today. But speaking of people of the ad tech industry, we have just announced our Ad Tech Personality of the Year and Ad Tech Rising Star long nominees list for the Wires Awards for this year. You can find the lists online. There's 30 names or so on each list, so I won't read them all out now, but do find them on exchangewire.com and get your votes in now. We'll be releasing the short lists in a few weeks. Anyway, thank you very much for listening today. We will be back with another Mad Tech podcast next week. Thank you.